On behalf of the D.C. Young Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society and the George Mason Student Chapter of the Federalist Society, I want to welcome you to the Antonin Scalia Law School. Tonight, we remember one of the greatest lawyers of his generation, William Consovoy, who passed away last January at 48. Will is well known in the George Mason community. A 2001 law grad, he was the first student from the school to clerk on the Supreme Court. He also mentored and influenced dozens of students as co-director of Scalia Law's Supreme Court Clinic. To reflect on his legacy, we've assembled a panel of those who knew Will personally and can speak about him as both a lawyer and a friend. Thomas McCarthy is a partner at Consovoy McCarthy PLLC, a boutique law firm he founded with Will Consovoy in 2014. In that role, Mr. McCarthy assists clients with a wide array of issues in the federal district and appellate courts, including those arising under the First Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, and other provisions of the U.S. Constitution. As Chief Trial Counsel for Students for Fair Admission at the University of North Carolina, he was a key part of a legal team that challenged racial preferences in college admissions, ultimately prevailing at the Supreme Court. For more than a decade, Mr. McCarthy has directed the Supreme Court Clinic here at the law school, from which he graduated in 2001. He holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Notre Dame. Next, we have Professor Todd Zwicky, the George Mason University Foundation Professor of Law at Scalia Law, and Senior Fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at George Mason's Mercatus Center. Specialist in law and economics, he often testifies before Congress and is a frequent legal commentator in print and broadcast media. Professor Zwicky has held numerous roles throughout his career, including Director of the Office of Policy Planning at the Federal Trade Commission, and recently, Chair of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Task Force on Federal Consumer Financial Law. He also received his JD from the University of Virginia, his MA in Economics from Clemson University, and his BA in Economics from Dartmouth College. And finally, Jennifer Mascott, Assistant Professor of Law and Co-Director of the C. Burden Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State at Scalia Law. She writes in the areas of administrative and constitutional law and serves as a Supreme Court contributor for NBC News. Professor Mascott has served as both Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel and the Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. After graduating from the George Washington University Law School with the highest cumulative graduating GPA on record, she was a law clerk to then Judge Brett Kavanaugh, and later for Justice Clarence Thomas, the same term as Will Consovoy. Please welcome our speakers. I wanted to start with you.
If you could, who is Will Consovoy, and why should we remember him?
So, who is Will Consovoy? Anybody that met Will, I think the things that you learn about him right away are that he's really just a regular guy, unassuming, personable, fun, easy to get along with. Great guy to chat with. I mean, he could talk to anybody about anything and enjoy doing it. Amazing personality, hilarious guy, incredibly generous with his time, the most loyal friend in the world. I didn't say brilliant yet, because that's not what you would notice at first. Because he was so unassuming. Because he was very much just a regular guy. But he was truly brilliant. It's funny, and I say it that way because in the last year or two, I've heard some things from other friends of him, other of his friends, some of his college friends, who told me they had no idea he was a really smart guy. They were like, it was like our senior year, and we were working on some project, and all of a sudden, a couple of us were like, "Wait, Will's like really smart. You guys know that?" They just thought he was an awesome guy. You know, and when we became friends here at the law school, we became friends mostly because we got along well. We had common interests that were mostly not the law. We bonded over college basketball and football and, you know, 90s pop culture stuff. And it wasn't for a little while till I realized, like, holy cow, this dude is really smart. But it had nothing to do with our relationship at all until we started, you know, doing sort of intellectual pursuits together. And when you think about that side of Will, it's definitely the case that he's truly brilliant. Anybody that worked with him, and certainly anybody that worked opposed to him, knew pretty quickly that he had everything up here. The most brilliant legal strategist I've ever met in my life. You know, I remember it was probably after we had been practicing for a while together, before even we started our firm, I guess. But somebody asked us how we were mapping out our legal strategy for a case where we were going to start the case with a complaint, hopefully get it to the Supreme Court. And, you know, in my own head, we were thinking about the legal theories we were pressing. We were thinking about the best way to advance them and what would be persuasive, what would be the facts we'd want to have if we could get them, put them together and make the right record to make the thing sound right when it got up the chain and all that. And Will said, it's really not that hard. What I do is I think through how the opinion would be written by the Supreme Court that decides the case in our favor. What's the most likely opinion that would be written that would get us the votes that would rule in our favor? And then I just work backwards from there, and it creates the whole legal strategy from the ground up. And when he said that, I said, huh? It was sort of astonishing. It was like, how could, like, it seemed so obvious to him, but I never met another person who said that or approached it in that manner. So in terms of who he was as an attorney, as a professional, that's one thing that should be remembered. Another is, and this goes with him being just a regular guy, unassuming, easy to get along with, is that he approached the law, the business side of practicing law, truly really as a profession. This is a bit of a throwback. It used to be that the bar was very collegial. People got along with each other. Things were done on handshakes. Everybody could trust in the word of what somebody said to them, even if they were on the other side. People would give each other breaks on stuff. Hey, you need a couple days because your kid is sick? No problem. There's less of that in the legal enterprise today. And I think that's for the worse for the practice of law and actually for the clients that people represent, because they don't get any benefit out of people, you know, pulling knives on each other, essentially, in a figurative sense, in the practice of law. Will was always civil in the way he practiced. He and I had the same view of how law should be practiced in that kind of sense, in that we both were crazy sports fanatics, and I still am. He still is, I'm sure. But we had the same sort of upbringing when it came to sports, in that you played as hard as you could to win every time. But you did so showing respect to your opponent, showing respect to the referee, and showing respect to the game itself. And so that's the way we thought was the only way to litigate. Fight as hard as you can to win every time, but with full respect for the people on the other side, you know, both the party, show them respect, show the opposing counsel respect, certainly show the court respect, and not just the judge, but everybody on the staff in that courtroom, and to the game itself. There's times, I think anybody who practices law, there's times when you might think less of the process or less of some player in that process, but you should always show respect for the process. And I think you did that as well as anybody. And I think it's a model of how we try to practice law at our law firm today. So now that I've rambled for a while, I'll give this back to you.
No, it's good.
Oh, this is my
Yeah, so my first year
career here 25 years ago as a law professor. I was a first year along with these guys, Tom and Will. We were over in the old building, the old Cons Department Store building. And back then, we professors, we taught, I taught the entire first year class day and night contracts. So probably 100 something students in your section. And I vaguely remembered these guys, right? In contracts with that many people, I think they probably sat in the back and smirked a lot, which suggests they weren't listening to the lecture, but certainly did well in the class. But I had the same impression of Tom as I remember you guys as just good guys, right? Sports fans and guys who I felt like I could get along with. And, you know, my first impression of Will, the first impression Tom talked about his personality, right? But he was a big guy, right? A big guy with a big smile and big hands. And, you know, when you shook your hand, it's like you knew your hand was being shook, right? You remembered this experience. And it was, and then it was after that, as we got into the upper class classes, that he just kind of turned it on. And I have to say, one of the great things was, as a professor, being a professor is an unbelievable privilege. The vocation to be entrusted to the next generation of lawyers is something I take very profoundly. And not every professor is as lucky to have one Will Consovoy in their life. And the gift that I had to as a professor have someone like him as a student, who just beginning his second year, he just kind of went on a tear. You know, as Tom was saying, this brilliance just started to shine, and the energy and the creativity. You could just see him sort of take off. And he took my public choice class. We could talk about that a little bit later. And I just kind of kept sort of following him. And by the time he graduated, he went on the clerk for Fairfax District Court, I believe. And this is the Arlington. I just knew the guy was the real deal. So I called up Judge Edith Jones on the Fifth Circuit. First time I ever did this for a student. I said, "Judge, you got to meet this guy, right? This guy is, you know, he's going places." And I think his academic record was a little bit undistinguished in his first year, but then he just took off from there. She met him. She hired him, right? Adored him, then adores him now. And that led to him then going on the clerk for Clarence Thomas after he got her foot in the door with Judge Jones. And I think that really kind of shows the story, right? Which is, he came here from, what was it, Monmouth. He really just worked hard, and his brilliance and hard work and character came through. And, you know, I was proud to introduce him to Judge Jones. Same thing happened there. And then, as Robert mentioned, he became the first, our first graduate to go on the clerk for the Supreme Court. And to have that privilege to have somebody like that as a professor, to be able to do what you can do to help, but then just see them grab the moment and make the most of it, is just something that's really remarkable to see. And now I've reached the stage in my career where I get these incoming students saying, "You know Will Consovoy? Will Consovoy was a student of yours?" Right? It's like these guys are legends. These guys are legends here at the law school now. And I remember when you guys left, were you a Wiley before you went? And I thought, these guys are crazy. Who leaves a big D.C. law firm and hangs out a shingle? And what's the strategy here that these guys are going to do? And look what they did. It's just a remarkable story, a remarkable testament to these guys, and I burst with pride every time I talk about you guys or think about you guys and what you've done. And I'll just say one last thing. In many ways, Will is in many ways a symbol of this law school. You know, scrappy, kind of came from nowhere, a little bit of a good sense of humor, and we don't take ourselves too seriously. You know, we take what we do seriously, but we don't take ourselves seriously. And that's kind of always been the Scalia Law way. And I think the fact that he was, you know, in the first class when I was here, I was kind of part of building what we have become. I couldn't imagine a better symbol in some sense of the law school to embody the culture we've built here, the culture you guys have been so valuable in contributing to.
Professor Moscow, what was it like working with Will in the 2008-2009 tournament? How did you first meet? How did you get to know each other?
Well, Will was just amazing. And, you know, listening to you all speak and you all out there who maybe some of you knew him, some of you not that well, it's almost hard to believe kind of that a person like this exists. I was just listening to a podcast this week. Sarah Isker, ABC News commentator, said he would be her pick for lawyer of the year in 2023 because, as these folks have pointed out, he was just this scrappy kid from New Jersey who went to Monmouth. And, you know, had plotted a 10-year strategy that resulted in one of the most significant Supreme Court cases in recent memory. And so it's hard to understand and know why the universe would have taken him from us so quickly. But I think my time clerking with him and knowing him shows even more depth, where despite all of that good guy natured aspect of Will and how funny he was and his sense of humor and his legal brilliance, it's really his character that stood out to all of us at the Supreme Court clerkship. It's a really intense year, and it's the kind of year that all of us who have done it and many of us who have not sort of aspire to as the pinnacle of what you would do as a lawyer. And so, you know, it has the capacity to just be very stressful and feel like there's a lot of pressure. And his character and his humility, his courage, his integrity, his grace really showed through that whole year and just throughout his career. And for those of us who clerked with him, and I think those of us who were friends with him, he was really our compass morally in a lot of ways. And just a few examples, one going back to the sort of scrappy guy that Will was and his humility, he and I clerked for Justice Thomas. You know, Justice Thomas has always been one who's willing to reach beyond the double Ivies to get folks with different experience. But that particular year, I think, was testing even the hopes and confidence of the fellow former Thomas clerks. Because there was a Creighton grad, a Rutgers grad, a Mason was not its esteemed 31 ranking at the time. I think we were more back down at 100 and GW. And back in the days, these like blogs or little chat rooms that would talk about the clerks were like, and then there's the TTT group for Justice Thomas, which at the time was third tier trash, literally. So the third tier trash showed up, the four of us, and Will quickly, like everybody knew, and I guarantee if you ask people today, most of them, even on the other side, would admit that he was like the smartest of the bunch. Like you would go to him to figure out what he was thinking in a case. He could persuade people. He always had like a unique mindset. He could always get his work done quickly. And he was just humble and he was nice about it. He also was a super good friend. Somehow in the midst of all that hard work, he developed these friendships with these guys that would continue for years and years afterwards, go on trips. There was a clerk who was on a justice, on the quote unquote other side of the spectrum, perhaps, of Justice Thomas, the first ever blind clerk that year of our term. And this fellow clerk was totally cool and great and totally competent in every single way, brilliant himself. But as you might imagine, without having your sight, you know, it can be hard to get in and out of the court and go home at night with the long hours we were keeping. And Will and team quickly became friends with Isaac and made sure literally like he had a drive home every single day. And Isaac didn't need it. He didn't ask for it, but they were there just to help him, but also become friends, like not pitying, but just respect and just a deep, 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 deep friendship. Also, Will, remarkably, with all of his character, was not judgmental about those of us who didn't always immediately have the confidence to reach the right answer or know where to go. And he, for me, I mean, I would fade in and out of his life because after clerking at the court, I made the very professionally astute decision to not work for, to not work basically for 8 years. So I was home mostly with kids. And so I would see Will periodically and sometimes have professional things I'd be doing. And he was the kind of person who a year could go by and I would have some question about some professional choice or be asked to do something I wasn't sure I had the courage to do. And you could literally call Will and spend, and he'd be the one person I would pick, and he would answer the phone, and he would talk for 10 minutes, and he would give an astute, sound, confident, calm, morally correct, courageous answer, and he would not judge you. He would not tell anybody. Like, that was a really big, I think, important lesson to take away from Will, is keeping confidentiality. You know, information is power around this town, but you could talk with him, and I'm telling you, he literally never thought less of you, and he would never, ever tell a single person. And there was one time in particular, 10 years after the clerkship in 2018, where I was asked in what was going to be a very big public spectacle to do something that could potentially be really impactful publicly, reputationally. And on a Sunday afternoon, I still remember to this day, like it was snowing or something or weird weather. And I called Will, and he was like, you know what? I really hate that you're being asked to do this. And you don't have to do it. I think you'd be totally fine not to do it. But if you're going to do this thing and you're going to get involved, you have got to decide and figure out that it is the right thing to do and be confident about it. And then you cannot look back. You have to be all in, and you have to move forward and not think at all about your public reputation. And it was exactly right. And what was remarkable about it is he would deliver these messages that were hard, but were right, in a very calm way. And I literally, after that, was able to have the confidence, knowing his sound judgment and his friendship and his integrity, that I could do it and not look back. And it was really because of that grounding of that conversation that carried that decision on for a few weeks. And then finally, generosity. Partly he could do these things because he was so efficient, but I had a fairly young baby when we clerked for Justice Thomas, and Will just had a lot of compassion. He was smart. He was like, you should go home and you should be with your baby, and we should try to have community here as much as we can. But, you know, something would happen. Like, one week I had to go home and was sick in bed kind of with my daughter, and Will, at the last minute, just took on basically my cert petition pull memo writing for that whole week, just without blinking an eye. Was like, you need to go home, you need to be there, and did this like hours of work of assignment. And I don't think to this day I ever had the time or chance to really repay him for that. But he would make decisions like that again and again, and actually is the one who got me employed at Mason, because I had been not working for like 8 years full time. And brought me in to run the Supreme Court clinic. He and Tom brought me in as a counsel. He sponsored my bar exam passage. And that was literally just like a run-of-the-mill friend decision for him. So I just, there's like words cannot describe. I still really, we were talking about this beforehand, and perplexed that the universe cannot have him here for decades more. But I think his impact in the time he was here is 10, 100, 1,000 fold what most of the rest of us can dream of.
What was Will like as a young lawyer practicing together at the firm? And then how did the two of you ultimately decide to go out on your own, risking your reputation and the uncertainty that comes with hanging up your own shingle?
So to work with, he was great. Like, we were buddies, and we've basically been like brothers since a couple months after we started hanging out together. I mean, and people who know me know this, but like literally brothers. Like, he came on my extended family's, like my parents and all of my brothers and my kids and our wives and nephews and nieces. He came to our summer family trip every summer, and all of my kids called him Uncle Will, so much so that my oldest, when she was about 10 one day, said to me, "Hey, wait, is Uncle Will not actually your brother?" No idea. But anyway, so he was great. I mean, we had the best time working together, which is, you know, a unique thing. Practicing law, especially if you practice it at a big law firm or intense cases and stuff, it's hard. It's intellectually stimulating but difficult. It's mentally sometimes and physically exhausting. If you do it with somebody that you like and respect, all that stuff that's really hard about it tends to go away, or at least not be so rough. So having him, you know, the two of us working together on stuff, we just had a good time together. I mean, we would joke sometimes that sometimes we, and this is going to sound really odd when I say this, but like, we would have to like pull an all-nighter sometimes when we were associates at Wiley Ryan, which is awful, right? Anybody who's ever done it stinks. But we would have times where we'd be working on a brief, and we would usually be in his office at the firm because he had a couch in his office. And it would be like, I would be working on the brief until I was exhausted. And then I'd be like, I'm going to take a nap. And then he would start working. And he'd get tired, he'd wake me up. And then we'd do the same thing. So, like, you know, we just had this way of working together. And then it happened when my wife and I, my wife Rachel, who was also a graduate of Georgia and then took professors away from class and stuff, she and Will and I studied together when we were in law school. But after we started having kids, she retired from the practice of law. But anyway, we had these four little kids. And so when Will and I were working on stuff together, he was always a late guy. He would sleep in late and he would stay up late. And I had all these little kids and I would be up like at odd hours of the night. So we had this thing where if we were working on something together, we literally had 24-hour coverage all the time because he was up till 2, 3 in the morning. I was always waking up at 3 in the morning. And so we always worked on stuff together. If there was like something time sensitive at the firm, we'd be like, well, let's just do this one together because we'll be able to figure it out. You know? And so it was really fun working together on stuff like that. And we had a good, it ended up being a good time, even the stuff that was really hard to do. And we worked hard. We did our best to achieve the best results we could. And obviously we enjoyed it when we had success. In terms of the firm and what made our decision to go start our own law firm, it's funny. I've only told a few people this, but like from the time we were in law school, we always wanted to go into business together. For a long time, it was not practicing law. He, as some people know, not only were we sports fanatics, but his original one of his first jobs was he was a college basketball coach. He was assistant basketball coach at Monmouth University after he graduated there. He had been the manager there. And he is, for anybody who's into sports basketball, he's literally the best X's and O's guy I've ever met in my life. Like, I'm a basketball junkie. I've been coaching basketball too, high school and youth and stuff for years and years. Best X's and O's guys ever, right? So when we were in law school, you know, knowing basketball and stuff, he said, hey, I have got this great idea. We should quit law school and start a basketball camp, but for teams to go to, not individuals, because the high schools will like it better because they're losing all these kids to all these camps and these AAU programs. We'd make a ton of money running these camps all over the country. It'd be incredible. We actually thought about it seriously for a while. And then we didn't do it. And then we were going to be sports agents because we were into sports. We thought the legal background. And I actually got certified by the NFL as a clerk agent. And he had buddies who were playing basketball in Europe and South America. And we were starting to do stuff for them. And then we decided not to do that because we fell in love with constitutional law. And then when we were practicing for a little while, it was like the start of like the whole e-discovery thing. That was like a new thing 20 years ago. And I got a chance to see it at the big firm I was at. And I was like, hey, we should do this. We should get out and run an e-discovery firm and supply contract attorneys. We'd make a zillion dollars doing the supply of the big law firms because we know how it works and all that stuff. And we decided to pass on that too. And eventually we just knew we were going to do something together. But for a few years, I kept sort of like twisting his arm saying, hey, we got to just start our own law firm. Let's do our own thing. It would be a lot of fun. It would be more fun to do our own thing. We would have a blast. We could find our own clients, pick our own cases, do stuff we really wanted to do, and have just way more fun doing it. And also, by the time we had been practicing for a while, we both realized that we had non-traditional schedules. Me because of all my children, and him because he was sort of a night owl kind of a guy. Like, if he was in the office during the daytime, it was not to work. It was to like socialize and goof off with people. So like if he was at the office and he came to my office, I was like, oh crap, I'm not getting any work done for the next couple hours because Will's going to want to talk about the Major League Baseball playoffs or something, you know. But, you know, we realized that big law firms want people to have a regular business day in a lot of ways. And that wasn't really suitable to me. It wasn't really suitable to him. And we figured if we go do our own thing, it's another way that we can just figure it out. We can do this 24-hour coverage thing if we want with our non-traditional schedules and get our work done for our clients. But it was sort of that. And then at some point, I kind of wore him down a little bit. And then at some point, I think he decided too that although we learned a lot at the law firms we were at and it was very valuable experience. And we had mentors we really liked and appreciated and respected, and we got to do really cool stuff. At some point, I think he was like, you know what? Let's do this. We both sort of figured we're kind of tired of having bosses. Let's go just do this on our own. It's funny. If you asked him that question, I could tell you what his answer would be while we started the firm, because he used this joke a lot. We happened to start the firm like shortly after we both turned 40. So he would say, oh, we turned 40. We both had a midlife crisis, decided to quit our jobs and just wing it. Which is probably partially true, but the rest of it is part of it too. And obviously, you know, we do a lot of work that is what people might call movement litigation or cause litigation. Some of that was near and dear to our heart. It wasn't the only reason we started the firm, but we wanted to be able to do some of that stuff. We wanted to be able to do things without having to worry about somebody else at the law firm saying, no, you can't do this, or some client saying, no, you can't do this. But a lot of it was, we just wanted to do our own thing, have our own practice law at the highest level we could, and have a good time doing it.
The anecdotes you're bringing up, Tom, make me think of a phrase the New York Times used in referring to Will, which was Jersey affability. And I was struck by that. You're noting a lot of sort of non-traditional paths, a different demeanor, a different background than maybe your average lawyer who's trying to go to the top 14, do big law, that sort of thing. This is to the panel. Do you think that made him a better lawyer? What were the pros and cons of that with regard to his personality? And what does it really say for law students and young lawyers who maybe are trying to go against the mold?
I think it probably did make him a better lawyer. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people that go to law school and to go on and do great things who have this idea in mind the whole time. They're going to do this and they've seen the model and that's how they do it. He didn't have any of that stuff. He almost didn't go to law school at all. When he decided to go to George Mason, it was a choice between that and taking a job at multiple colleges that were trying to hire him as a sort of one step up the ladder of an assistant basketball coach. And a couple of the coaches actually knew that he was thinking about law school, and they were offering him scholarships to go to their law schools if they would coach basketball. And he ultimately decided he wanted to do one or the other, because if he did both, he would probably not do either one well. And he decided to try law school. So, you know, he came at this at a very much, you know, non-traditional route. And, you know, Monmouth is not usually where people start if they want to clerk at the Supreme Court. I don't know. Jen would know better than me. But, you know, I think it made him a little bit unconventional, for sure. But I also think it, you know, in a way, it's sort of freeing him of the mold that everybody's used to. You know, I think he was definitely a very creative thinker. And part of that is he was a scrappy guy. You know, he was always working hard to try to find what's a better way. We don't have to do it the way everybody's been doing it. Just because that's the way they do it doesn't mean it's right. It's just the way they do it. Maybe we can find a better way to do this, to write that, to make this argument, to strategize on how to bring this case, you know, to fight that issue. You know, I think it was definitely part of it.
That's a great point, Tom. And I think it resonates with me, this idea of, given where he came from and through his own hard work and brilliance, he did what he did. I mean, he's the ultimate sort of anti-establishment lawyer, right? The ultimate guy who's not going to bow down to authority. He's not going to do things the way they do it just because you say you can't do that, right? I'm glad you explained it was just a joke that you guys had a midlife crisis, because when you started a firm, I thought, what do these guys do? Have a midlife crisis and decide to go start their own firm? But even that, the model that you guys have created, you guys made the model, right? I mean, it's like this kind of combination of movement litigation that has changed the world, together with very high level private representation and the like. I mean, I'm not familiar with firms that did that before you guys. And I think a lot of this is a testament to that, right? The outsider, the guy who's done it on his own, who didn't have the connections, who has no reason to trust the authorities and the establishment and the way things have done been done before. I think it's probably not a coincidence, you know, the fact that he clerked for Edith Jones and Justice Thomas, who have very similar attitudes, right, in terms of looking for qualities of character and the like, kind of gravitated, kind of formed this network of people around him who share a sense of integrity and hard work. I won't say necessarily anti-establishment, but certainly, not necessarily hostility to the establishment, but certainly no deference, no unnecessary deference to the establishment or kissing the ring or anything like that. I mean, one of the things that always kind of, what I think about, well, one of the things that always struck me is that I've rarely met many people in my life who are as comfortable in their own skin as him, right? He just was who he was all the time, whether he was, you know, as a lawyer, whether I was sitting with him in George Mason basketball game, or saw him at a Federal Society event, right? He just was always who he was. As Jen said, he always kind of felt like he had a sense of as much time as he wanted to have with him, and a genuine interest in who you are, and not that sort of DC sort of thing, which is who else is more important in the room that I want to see, right? And I think that kind of came through, just that comfort in who he was, that quiet confidence. That he never seemed rattled, he never seemed hurried, and to do what you guys did, I think really took courage, and to see how well you did it is amazing. And I think that's a testament to what you're saying about this idea of, well, here's what I want to do. Why can't I do it, right? Just because it's never been done before, why does that mean it can't be done? Right? I think we can figure this out. And I think that's just an unbelievable spirit of practicing law, but also just towards life, right? In how you approach people and the like.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I think because he didn't have pretense, he could just afford and take the time to figure out the answer, to learn it, to get it right, to get to the bottom of something. He also spent a lot of time getting principles in line. So, I mean, it's amazing, just those of you who are early in your legal practice, if you take the time to think about theories of interpretation or the Constitution or why is the country set up the way it is, why do we do what we do, then you have a construct for figuring everything out. And he just would have a deep sense, cutting to the chase, of like a few principles of what is right, what is true, what's the principle of law in this country. And that drove everything and always gave him clear insight, number one. Number two is Todd saying, he definitely was not going with the establishment. What's interesting is that often when we say that today, it's people who have a little bit of an edge. They're kind of rebellious. They've got an attitude. He was not that. He was so respectful. He was so non-assuming. He just, again, cared about like integrity and character. And one final thing that I don't think we've said yet is he was a very good listener of everyone, like of his friends. But I think this was one reason he got along really well with Justice Thomas is, you know, Justice Thomas is a storyteller, and we would all sit in his chambers and talk for very long periods of time. And Will would just listen intently to the justice and to everybody. And I think that's why you had the sense that he valued you and thought you were important, because then he would also have a sense of what would make people tick. And then he would care and he would respond to it in kind. So he got a lot more done than the rest of us, because we're just sort of on our rat race, on our wheel, trying really hard to get it done. And he's just sort of sitting back a little bit, I think, and taking it all in. And like you said, somehow able, Tom, just to cut through everything very quickly.
What are the consequential cases in which he was involved? And which one do you think, for which one will he be best remembered?
I mean, you should say that as his partner. I mean, I think the common populace will think it's the Harvard and UNC cases. I mean, when Tom says planning 10-year strategy, I mean, really, I mean, you all know I was having babies at the time, but like you guys were thinking about essentially Asian Americans are being discriminated against. Like, and I remember talking to you all tangentially during the time that all this discovery and all the time with Harvard and building the facts of the case, just years and years and years and years and years. And it's almost hard to believe now looking back that the decision's been issued. And also somewhat tragic that it kind of happened after Will was sick. But that gets to another point about Will. And Tom won't say this because he's too humble too. But at their firm, everybody loves to work there because they're super smart and they give opportunities to everyone. It is so hard in this town to get a Supreme Court argument. And like six of your attorneys have gotten arguments just because they worked with you. Part of it was creativity, starting the Supreme Court clinic here, which allowed them to get the expertise to claim credentialing and have credentialing to argue in the court. But then Will was very steadfast, and everybody knew that everybody was going to take a turn. And anytime the firm got Supreme Court litigation, it was going to start from the top partner and go one by one all the way down to every guy. And I think like people who were associates 5 years ago, you've had argue or are going to be arguing. And it's just generous and smart and atypical in this town.
In terms of like case to be remembered for, I think it's got to be people are always remembered for the Harvard and UNC cases. I mean, those were a big, big deal, obviously. They're, you know, one of the most consequential opinions, I think, of sort of this generation at the Supreme Court. And we'll probably have lasting effects, not only in that area of the law, but probably spread to other areas of law. But there was, you know, lots of other big cases along the way. And I'll say this is that, you know, if you asked him, he probably would say he wouldn't know, mostly because he was never in it. Like to be a big deal himself, which is part of why, like, you know, nobody tries to hog Supreme Court arguments at our law firm, right? It was never about any individual. And also at the same time, you know, he and we've always tried to instill this at our firm is that every client is important and their matter with us is the most important thing in the world to them. So, and I think, you know, this is not necessarily novel. I think there's a lot of lawyers that think that way. They should think that way. You know, we have a duty to represent our clients zealously. And to really do that right, you have to appreciate how important the matter is to them. So he might not have said, yeah, Harvard's the most important or anything. Maybe he would, but he might have said, well, they're all super, super important. Every single one of them. Maybe most of you never heard of most of them. But I can promise you that he thought every single one of them was incredibly important.
I was struck when Will passed away, he received tributes from people across the political spectrum. Neil Katyal, for example, many others. And yet, he was involved in many controversial decisions or cases. How will he be perceived by those with whom he disagreed? And what should they be able to take from his life, if they're being honest and fair, that or a student could take, say, if he or she disagrees with Will's political or legal perspective, but nevertheless maybe sees him as someone who could be a model moving forward?
I mean, it's an excellent point you bring up, right? That people who he fought long and hard against, who disagreed with him vehemently on some of the most hot button political issues of the day, that fought tooth and nail against him in court, said only nice things about him. That's because they got to know him a little bit. That's because they saw the things that Jen and Todd and I mentioned, that he was a personable guy, that he was a regular guy, that he was totally unassuming, that he was generous with his time, that he treated everybody with respect, that he would do a favor for someone if he could. So all those people, you know, they say nice things. And I think what will last, you know, hopefully the message that will come across, obviously he's going to be remembered for the successes that he had in his career, but hopefully the thing that people will take away, law students, other people in the field, that it doesn't cost you anything to be a good person, right? And you should try to be a good person. You should do your best to, you know, like I said before, show respect for your opponents, for everybody else, to treat them kindly, treat them professionally, to treat them civilly. I think that comes across with anybody who actually knew him, knew how good of a guy he was. And hopefully that will be something that people in the legal profession will remember. Hopefully that will be something that helps to improve that type of attitude, persona in the legal profession. Hopefully that'll be something that the next generation of lawyers will take to themselves and remember, and when they go out in their careers, try to practice in that same way. Because that's the way everybody should be acting in the first place. But even aside from that, I think it will bring more respect to the profession. It'll bring better quality of representation to individual clients. It'll really make the process better. Frankly, we'll get better results if people are focused on doing their job well and properly and treating each other respectfully along the way.
I was just going to say, also, he was very honest. Like, you always knew he was going to give you the straight answer and not pull something like Tom said before, which I think is really great. What's striking about Neil Katyal's comments, I think, in that article was that he called him a generational legal talent. But he also said, I think in the New York Times, and I miss him. And that's really, like, profound. If one of your top intellectual adversaries at that level says in a vulnerable way, I miss him. I mean, what a legacy, what an impact he's had intimately on many, many high-level practitioners here.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, a lesson I think that younger lawyers could take away of is just his integrity, right? The sense that it wasn't about him. It wasn't about showboating. You know, it wasn't about getting headlines. I recall speaking to him when they were preparing the New York Times profile on him. I think it was before one of the Trump oral arguments, right? And it was striking to me at the time that nobody knew who he was, like in the general public, right? He wasn't always self-promoting, that sort of thing. He was just doing his job. And what came through, and I think what guys like Neil Katyal are picking up on, is he was clearly a man of strongly held convictions, but they were well-reasoned. They were well-defended. He wasn't taking political positions and then dressing them up as legal positions and the like. Is he had integrity. He had the integrity that he believed in his positions. He understood why they were, what the limits of them were, and that sort of thing. And when you come up across somebody like that who believes what they believe because they've really thought about it and they believe it's morally right, and not because they're trying to persuade you to come along with it, right? Who respects that you may not agree, right? I would hope, obviously, he hopes the judge will agree. But this sense that I've thought about this, this is what I believe, and a genuine sense, you may not agree, and that's all right, right, is, I think, a very powerful sort of a sense of how you deal with people. And that's what I always got from him, was that sense of integrity and respect for other people, and modeling something that was then reflected back, that people respected him, even if they didn't agree with his politics or whatever.
Let's take a few questions from the audience. Well, oh, yes, ma'am. Yeah, the question is about Will's writing. How did he do it?
So, Will didn't consider himself a naturally gifted writer, but he was an excellent writer. But the truth is probably somewhere in between. Of all the brilliant attorneys I've known in my life, Will wasn't the most naturally gifted. But in the same way he approached everything else, he just wanted to do the best he could at everything he did. So he just worked and worked. It was a little bit like, and I often reflect on sports because it was so much a part of him and a part of our relationship, is that he always thought he always owed his best to his teammates, to whoever his captain or boss was, to whoever his client was. And so he worked incredibly hard at his writing. And I can maybe give you a sense of this by noting something he said once. When we were at Wiley Ryan, he was put on a panel to speak to new associates. This is when we were like senior associates or something, about, you know, how to be professional and how to, you know, work hard and practice law the right way and all that kind of stuff. And after he was on this panel, he was never allowed to do it again because of what he said when someone asked him a question. Someone said to him, "How many times do you reread your first draft and revise it before you turn into a partner?" And Will says, "Between 30 and 40. And he scared the heck out of all these young associates. They were like, "My God, I have to rewrite a thing 30 or 40 times before I give it to a partner?" He was dead serious, of course. And the partners were like, "You can't tell them that." But that's what he did. Because he just, you know, and he just worked on it from a macro level at first. Like, as soon as he got it on paper, you know, we had a different approach. I always outline stuff. He said, "I can't outline because I don't know how it's going to turn out. I just need to write it. I need to write the whole thing." And then he'd read it the first time and say to himself, "Big picture, do I have the right theme here? Okay, next time. If that's my theme, did I organize things at a high level in the right order?" Right? And then go from there until he finally gets to, "Are all my sentences tight? Okay, is every word I use in each sentence, in the entire thing, the right word to do the job that it's doing in that sentence?" And so that's what he did. It was just that he worked so hard on his craft and tried so hard to get it right that by the time he was done, you could ask him why he used a particular adjective in the second paragraph of subpart B of Roman numeral 3, and he would have actually thought seriously about that particular word in that sentence. That's why he was so good, because he was so committed to his craft.
Well, now, and obviously one of the major predicates for clear writing is clear thinking, right? Being able to think very logically, and that's the great skill of a lawyer, is to be able to organize thoughts in a logical manner and unpack them in a logical manner, and clear thinking reflects that. I do have to tell one story about writing as a professor. He took my public choice in the law class, and you have to do a term paper as part of that class. And he picked up the idea of game theory and the prisoner's dilemma. And he came up with an idea, and it's kind of cool because I think of this literally every year, because when I ended up writing, co-authoring a public choice book, we actually discuss his term paper in the book. And so every year I get to tell the story of Will Consovoy talking about this. And to cut to the chase, the theory is that the mafia emerges as the solution to the prisoner's dilemma. I never asked why a boy from New Jersey knew so much about the mafia. I just took it for granted that he had some. Yeah, I didn't want to know, right? He just took judicial notice of some commonly known facts, apparently. But it just it was just a great, brilliant idea, and it had that virtue. It's like when he explained it, it was like, of course, right? There's a problem here. The mafia emerges as a way of making sure these guys don't rat each other's out in the prisoner's dilemma, right? Problem solved. But he's earned a discussion and a footnote and a citation in our public choice book for that. So.
Let's take one more question.
Will the Entrepreneur?
So I think the thing I can say is something I think Todd touched on, which is just, why not? Like, no fear, right? There were a couple times when I was trying to twist his arm and start running a law firm, and he would say to me, like, but neither one of us has run a business before. And I reminded him that he, when he was like in high school, was the manager of a bagel shop for a little while. And I had a paper route when I was like 13. So I was like, we can figure this out. But really, he had no fear. It was just like, yeah, we can figure this out. Other people do this stuff. Like, starting a business, what is it? Like, we can figure it out. People start businesses every day in this country. You know, we might not be the smartest guys walking around town, but we can do it. We can find clients. We can work hard and do a good job for them. Why not? Let's go do it. So it's mostly just like completely fearless. And like I said, he's a very unassuming guy. He didn't show everybody or try to show anybody how smart he was, but he was confident in his own abilities. He was confident in his principles. He was confident in who he was. And I think he just, you know, knew we can make it work. Creative guy, not only smart in a legal sense and, critical analytical thinking sense, but, you know, although we like to say we winged it, which we did in some respects, you know, we spent some time looking at the legal market and figuring out what was going on and where, you know, a couple of guys might fit in a little boutique. Somebody likened us to a two-man garage band when we started. But like, you know, how do we make this work? How do we make it fit? And he was thoughtful about all that stuff. You know, it shouldn't surprise anybody because he was really thoughtful and spent a lot of time thinking about anything that captured his imagination. He didn't let it go until he was like satisfied that, okay, I've covered the terrain as much as there is to cover it. But yeah, fearless guy. And that's the same way he approached the law too. And the fact that he could stand up for principle. And I think Jen mentioned it, just unafraid to stand up for things he believed in and do what he felt was right.
Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we miss him. It's amazing the impact he had on so many of us as a person, and the impact that he had on the world as a lawyer. But I think he's really a role model for many of us, and the way in which they've mentored young lawyers over there shows that, I mean, it was really, you know, brilliance without errors, dedication without obsession, commitment to his principles without zealotry. I mean, it's like this incredible balance of brilliance and commitment and dedication with a complete normalcy, a complete full-rounded human being who kind of kept everything in balance in a remarkable sort of way. It's it's really profound that a guy who we lost so early has had such an impact on so many people and on the world.
Courage, humility, and loyalty.
Let's thank our panel.